Speaking of things that are a little bit more, maybe not in the future, but definitely what was seen as a, you know, a radical new way to do the hotel industry, Airbnb came out with a bang, what, 10 years ago or so. There's been complications back and forth. The prices are going up. And you wrote an interesting piece about those of us that use Airbnb are expecting too much from Airbnb. What inspired you to write this story for the Wall Street Journal?
Well, some hosts say that guests are expecting too much, but it came out of conversations that I have with hosts a lot of the time where in some cases they feel squeezed because their costs are going up, so they're charging more. There's also more demand, so they can charge more, but they think that people who are staying in their homes are forgetting the original concept of Airbnb, which was to share your home with somebody rather than create a mini hotel. So I decided to look into that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. I also feel that some ways about Uber. It was supposed to be like you're sharing a ride with someone who just, quote unquote, happened to be going in that direction. Of course, it evolved into something completely different, as is Airbnb. Airbnb. Let's dive into it. What were some of the examples of hosts having to kind of bend over backwards to please the people that are renting out their places?
Yeah, so I spoke to one woman who rents out her home in Minneapolis when she's traveling for work, and she bought toys so that families with kids could stay there. They'd have plenty of toys, tons of games. She has 4 TVs in the house, but she got feedback that her house was poorly stocked, and so she thought, where is it poorly stocked? So she mentioned that in some ways it feels like you can never exactly meet people's expectations because they're asking for more.
Right. Is it partly to blame, though, that Airbnb costs are so high? And also, there are so many complaints, and I have it too, that the price that you think you're going to pay is exponentially higher when you actually hit the pay button because of cleaning fees and so many other things that make it feel a little bit more hotelish than maybe Airbnb likes to pretend that it is. Do you kind of understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And so Airbnb has gotten a lot of criticism for cleaning fees and especially for the list of tasks that people have to do before they check out. So I'm sure you've heard from people who are like, why do I have to do all these chores before I check out if I'm paying several hundred dollars in a cleaning fee? So that definitely adds to the dynamic. And Airbnb has changed some things where they now display the total price. So you can search and look for the total cost, including the cleaning fee, but you actually have to toggle that on. You have to change that display yourself. It's not the default in most places as well.
Does this run into problems for hosts who put their places up if they somehow miss an expectation that someone who stayed there had? That seems strange, like you should have more toys for kids. I wouldn't have thought of that or anything along those lines. Is the risk there that they get a bad rating? And since it's so rating-driven, that really that these expectations that travelers may have can really do some harm to some hosts' places that other people would find perfectly fine?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So the rating system on Airbnb is technically 1 to 5 stars, and people do use all the stars when they rate. But when you search for a property, most of the properties listed are between 4.5 and 5 stars. So you're really looking at a difference of decimal points when you're searching for the difference between these properties. So a 1 or 2 star review can really drag somebody down in a dramatic way. And some people will do that if they've had a bad experience or a picky complaint. So that's always a concern for hosts, and they have to pay attention to the guests' experience and what they want.
Where do we go from here? I mean, I've kind of wondered, and you probably know more about this, of is Airbnb built to last here, or do people really have to kind of recalibrate what they think Airbnb is, what the cost of it's going to be, and are people starting to consider hotels just as much as they used to? Like, have we kind of seen this pendulum sway back and forth?
If you look at bookings on Airbnb, there's no sign that the pendulum is moving away, though I know a lot of people talk about their frustrations with the fees, but they kind of say the same thing about hotels, too. So it still remains to be seen what will happen in that regard, but I do think Airbnb is positioning itself more as a place for group stays. So if you're traveling with a group or with a family, they're positioning themselves as the default option that's more convenient than a hotel. So that's one tactic that they're using. And I think guests also have some legitimacy to what they're expecting. I mean, nobody wants to go to a property that isn't like the listing, and you don't want to be surprised when you walk in. So it is reasonable to expect hosts to do proper disclosure and advertising and to charge a fair rate.
For sure. Allison Poley, a lot more in your article at WallStreetJournal.com, WSJ.com, I should say. Thanks for your time. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Spent most of the news break texting back with our incredible listeners and their many thoughts on cursive. I'd say I'm in the minority opinion on this one from the text line, though some people do agree with me. A lot of people have great arguments about fine motor skills with cursive. I just suggest there's other ways to teach fine motor skills in a more 21st century way. Someone did bring up the idea of just the cursive writing and writing in general, using your brain to be creative and come up with new things and thoughts. That I would agree with is wonderful. I think you can do that typing perhaps or in another skill set, but I think that was probably the best argument. As someone who is the son of a public school art teacher, I will make no arguments. And as someone who was raised on the arts and the imagination of the brain, maybe it was tied to my cursive more than I realize. I don't know. That's a great one. But you can keep those thoughts coming. And I don't know exactly when. I should ask Andrew or Brian if he knows when they're going to talk about this tomorrow on Lisa Dent's show. But absolutely chime in with Lisa tomorrow. She'll have more time for it. It's an interesting discussion, to be sure. I'd love to talk to an educator about that, about the benefits, truly, of what cursive brings to people besides signatures, etc. Okay, I'm going to leave that where it is. Keep on texting. Y'all know during the commercial breaks, I like to text back. But every now and then, I like to peer in. Speaking of the youth and the future, TikTok, of course, as of now, an app where a lot of people get, you know, we talk about financial literacy, Iridian. That's where a lot of people get financial advice, good or bad, right?
Yeah, that's where, you know, Girl Math was basically born for me. Yeah,
that's right, where we talked about Girl Math last year. And, you know, I've seen a lot of good ones, too, like people talking about debt, people talking about student loans, explaining it. But you really have to do your homework with any financial advice you get on TikTok, right? And yeah. I think this story puts it into perspective.
Yeah. So over the weekend, people were talking about this Chase Bank hack or a glitch, you know, so to say. People were going and writing checks that were fraudulent and depositing them. And then let's say for $20,000. And then they were, you know, withdrawing $10,000 before Chase realized that there was actually no money there.
So this was a hack that someone said, look, you can just write a check to yourself from someone else, a fake check, deposit it into your bank account. Sometimes banks give you like half of the deposit right away or a certain amount. Take that money out and then they thought that was a hack?
Yeah, they thought that was a way to get free money. And this is where maybe the importance of financial literacy comes in, right? If someone would have been like, hey, you're actually committing fraud. This is not a hack. That totally would have helped people.
Do we have any idea how many people did this or?
No, but there was a lot of TikTok videos on it. So I do have a little bit of audio people giving their comments on the whole trend or situation. So we can listen to that.
Okay.
Listen. Everybody that gets caught up with that Chase glitch, it's not a glitch, it's fraud. It's check fraud. And it has been around for since before you were born. It's a felony. You're going to jail.
For the past 2 days, I've heard nonstop about this whole Chase Bank glitch scheme, right? And I thought this whole time it was this elaborate, big scammer, like breakthrough or something like that. Turns out the whole time it's just basic check and wire fraud. So for those of you who don't know how it works, basically they took their own Chase bank account, right? And they made a bad check, a check for like $50,000 or up that they couldn't, like they knew they couldn't cash, right? They wrote a check to themselves that they knew they could not cash. And then what they would do is they would either try and withdraw it or they would try and just wire it to another account and close their Chase bank account.
Insane.
Yeah. That's no good. Yeah, this is where you're making my point here a little bit for me. Although a lot of people are making the fine point, too, that you can do both financial literacy and cursive. Maybe. I'm not a teacher. I don't make the curriculum. But okay. So don't do that. So you're saying?
Yeah, don't do that. That's not great. And, you know, people made a lot of fun of Girl Math, but at least that was nowhere near fraud. Like the money was there.
Right. That was that the quote unquote girl fraud was justifying, like, if you got 20% off something, spending way more because, hey, you got a deal. Okay. All right, Rudy, thanks for our weekly TikTok trend.
You got it.
I look forward to that. Tell your kids and grandkids, don't commit check fraud. And let's teach that in the schools, too. Okay, 6:45. Time for traffic weather. Mary, did you pay attention to that last segment?
No, what's a check?
Interesting nugget of the professional world nowadays is LinkedIn, right? It's a professional way to present yourself to potential employers of the future. And it's a place to go if you need a job. Well, there's a debate right now about one of the mechanisms that exists in LinkedIn to make it clear that you need a new job and whether or not you should use it. I hope that made any sense. Aki Ito from Business Insider will help explain it a little better. Hello, welcome back to the program.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Did I set that up correctly, what we're talking about, this banner thing on LinkedIn?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Open to Work banner on LinkedIn is this feature that the platform has had for a few years now, and it basically allows you to announce to your entire network of professional peers, I'm looking for a job. I would like your help. It kind of stamps this green banner on your headshot that says hashtag open to work.
And I think that makes sense, right? You're on LinkedIn for essentially making these connections. Maybe the average person, if they're scrolling through, doesn't realize who needs a job or who's looking. And boom, you see this thing that looks a little different. They're open to work. Aha, my brain goes off. I could connect so-and-so with so-and-so. But it doesn't always work like that in reality, does it?
Yeah, that's the thing. It makes total sense when you think about it rationally like that. But the thing is, you know, we humans are often irrational. We have all kinds of biases. And one of the biases we have is this stigma against people who are unemployed. So there's a lot of commentary online, you know, on LinkedIn and on other platforms as well, that really, like, there's a huge debate about whether it's good for job seekers to use this. A lot of haters of the banner say that, you know, it's the kiss of death, that it makes you look desperate. It's like asking for a handout. But then there are other people who say, like, of course you should use it. Job seekers should use every single tool in their toolbox. So it ends up leading to a lot of confusion for job seekers. I call it, you know, in my story, this agonizing rite of passage now for the newly unemployed.
Do you talk to any employers or people that do hiring about what they think about the banner?
Yeah, so I ended up speaking to 8 different recruiters for this story. And even though, you know, there's so much commentary online that's like, oh, recruiters see this as a turnoff, like recruiters will never hire you if they see the banner on your profile, that just turns out to be total garbage. 7 of the 8 recruiters I spoke to said they either feel neutral about it or, if anything, they actively seek out people with this banner on because it means that they're more likely to respond to their messages. They're more serious job seekers than those passive job seekers who already have a job. So that's certainly, you know, one reason why I think that job seekers actually should be using this banner, even if it might feel a little embarrassing.
I wonder if the banner's, the vibe around the banner changes based on the economy. Like a recruiter over the last couple of years, when labor was short at many companies, had to find people that were serious, right? They want to get people positioned into jobs that really need a new job. And there aren't many people who did, right? The unemployment level was so low. Does the stigma, I don't know, change a little bit when people are hiring less and maybe they're being more stingy about who they hire, that maybe if that pivot happens to the labor market getting a lot tighter, that maybe the banner would kind of seem as a cry for desperation? Do you kind of see what I'm talking about the vibe shift in the economy?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think there's a different way to kind of see that, too. You know, there's a big reason why LinkedIn rolled this feature out in June 2020, which was the height of the pandemic when, you know, tens of millions of Americans were suddenly losing their jobs. And it's because, you know, unemployment was suddenly this thing that everybody was going through, not just, you know, this you know, random person that you don't know. And as a result, unemployment became less stigmatized. When the economy got better, I think it became harder for people to use the banner because it wasn't this thing that everybody was going through anymore. It was just something that it felt like it was just you, you know, because everybody else had a job when when the unemployment rate was at like 3.5%. When you look at, it's interesting kind of looking specifically at the tech industry too, because in tech, there have been a ton of layoffs over the last 2 years. And so, specifically when you talk to tech workers and tech recruiters today, you know, they have such an deep understanding that layoffs can happen all the time, that they happen really randomly, that they're indiscriminate, that it has nothing to do with performance. And as a result, I wonder if people in the tech sector now are much more, you know, kind of understanding of people who have the banner compared to, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, they've been through it themselves, that industry. Aki Ito joining us from Business Insider, talking about people on LinkedIn using the hashtag ready to work banner around their profile when they're looking for the job. And some people saying it's like a kiss of death or makes you look worse. Yeah, it's fascinating. You mentioned that unemployment rate thing, that when unemployment peaked around 13 or 14% right at the start of the pandemic, you know, there was this we're all in this together attitude towards it. And now that unemployment's been at or below 4% for a long time, it's like, well, why couldn't you have gotten a job? I wonder, Aki, is it this is like the new hole in your resume? Like when you apply for a job and someone says, well, why haven't you had a job in the last 6 months? It's like, I'm applying for a job for a reason, dude. Like, mm-hmm. is that kind of what this is now?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, you know, one job seeker I spoke to said it's totally bizarre. You know, saying, you know, I'm not going to give you a job because you said you need a job is like saying I'm not going to feed you because you said you're hungry. It makes absolutely no sense. But unfortunately, there is that bias out there. The thing that I talk about in my story, though, is that I think those norms are shifting, you know, pretty quickly, perhaps partly because LinkedIn has rolled out this open to work banner, which is so public on the platform. It's the first thing that you really see. It's very visible. And because so many people have been more open about their experiences getting laid off since the pandemic, I think it's becoming normalized in a way that, you know, maybe will help reduce that stigma over time.
Yeah, and I imagine some of the stigma holds on from generations who had one job their whole life, and that was all they did. Part of this newer way of doing things where you have multiple different jobs or careers, that natural turnover may result in you not choosing to leave a job, but them choosing to leave you at some point. Hopefully that stigma continues to go away. And, you know, honestly, I kind of find it refreshing that LinkedIn does it and that other people feel confident just to post that when they're looking for a job. Because, Aki, so much of social media is trying to put a false front on who you are and how happy you are in life. In the professional world, there's, I don't know, something refreshing about saying, hey, me, like millions of others, we need some help. Can you help?
Yeah, that's so true. That's such a good point. Yeah, usually the things that we see on LinkedIn are kind of like the, you know, I'm so humbled to have been promoted to senior director of the company kind of thing. So, yeah, you're absolutely right that these layoff posts, you know, are kind of a more, you know, vulnerable side of our everyday lives. And some of that is uncomfortable, you know. In my story, I talk about how these open to work banners, you know, I think part of the reason why some people are uncomfortable with them is because it's kind of like seeing somebody's private suffering that you're not supposed to see. But, you know, by breaking those taboos, by being more open about these things, you know, we can create a different society where unemployment isn't so stigmatized.
Yeah.
According to one estimate, you know, 40% of Americans are likely to be laid off at least once. So if it hasn't happened to us already, it's probably going to happen to us in the future.
This was a great read. You know, it's such about a specific little thing, but it widens out to so much more. Aki Ito, as always, great to chat with you. Come back again, okay?
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
That was interesting. Okay, that's going to do it for Your Money Matters tonight. We'll be back tomorrow night. News next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN.